Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 2020 has arrived, and with it, the 2020 election. Democrats, almost all of them, have been vying against each other in the race for the White House. That field has narrowed substantially in just the last few weeks, heading into the Iowa caucuses. The South Carolina primary is coming up on Leap Day, February 29th. The North Carolina primary is just days later, on March 3rd. Republicans continue to be uncommonly loyal to Donald Trump, who faces an impeachment trial in the Senate. Meanwhile, the GOP has found success in eliminating primaries around the country to ensure the renomination of the president. North Carolina has new legislative and congressional maps, and at least for the upcoming primary, will still not require voter ID, thanks to a court order temporarily suspending a requirement voters okayed in the last election cycle. In short, a lot to talk about, and we kick off a year-long regular discussion about politics in 2020, beginning today as we welcome three political junkies to the program. Jim Morrill is the longtime political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
Scott Huffman is a professor of political science at Winthrop University and creator and keeper of the Winthrop Poll, the Palmetto State's barometer to track political mood swings among voters there. Thank you for being back with us.
My pleasure.
And Steve Harrison is our political reporter at WFAE News and the co-host of Inside Politics podcast, which starts on January 23rd. Thank you for being here. You were just here on Friday, weren't you?
That's right. Back
again. In that same chair.
Same chair.
We'll put your name on it. let's start with impeachment, since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is likely to send the articles of impeachment to the Senate this week. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell still hasn't said that he will allow witnesses to testify. That's what Democrats want and what Pelosi has been waiting for. Is all of this, Jim, just an exercise in futility with a foregone conclusion, the acquittal of the president?
Yeah, I think it is, in so many words. You know, I think there's a little drama over the rules that the whether, like you said, whether there'll be witnesses or not and other evidence. But at this point, I think the conclusion is pretty foregone.
So impeachment is a political process, not a legal one, although it does result sometimes. It could result, never has, could result in the removal of a president from office. But in the two previous attempts in the modern era at impeachment, the one with Richard Nixon, which didn't come to impeachment because he resigned before it could, and Bill Clinton, which did result in impeachment in the House, but I think an acquittal in the Senate, witnesses were called in those two processes, but the whole thing seemed less political, even though it was certainly political. Is that my imagination, Scott?
Well, the Senate, even during the Bill Clinton time, I mean, you know, it was clearly political. They were trying to nail this guy for anything, but there was a greater sense of decorum. The Democrats and the Republicans sat down beforehand and sort of worked out what the rules were going to be and that both sides would, you know, adhere to them. There's none of that this time. And that's because, you know, we have to say this every bloody political podcast, polarization. And it's happened in the Senate as well as the House. You know, the conservatives and the liberals have gotten further and further apart. And, you know, that's just, you know, political science has proven that over and over. They're just getting so far apart that they can't come together on the rules.
You got to remember, in 1999, during the Clinton trial, Fox News and MSNBC were just a few years old. And so that's one reason we weren't as polarized then as we are now.
Did it help that the antagonist here was Ken Starr? And he was not a member of Congress. He was a special prosecutor that brought these charges, and the Congress took them up, as opposed to a Jerry Nadler or a Adam Schiff running roughshod, apparently, according to Republicans, over Republicans. Was it different because of that?
I mean, I don't remember. I remember the Democrats demonized Ken Starr pretty thoroughly.
And he wasn't a member of Congress.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I hear what you're saying, but I think it was like, I just remember they targeted him fiercely. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't, whoever brings forth the charges, whether it's Congress or a special prosecutor, I think they're going to get creamed.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Way.
I mean, the reputation, of course, the law that allowed the special prosecutor is no longer in place, so they couldn't create the same kind of special prosecutor now that they had then, unless they sort of re-upped it. The interesting thing I'm waiting to see is, because of the polarization, because they haven't been able to come to an agreement over the rules, anything John Roberts does as presiding over it, they can literally ignore him. It's as you pointed out, it is political, not legal. So if he said, well, I'm going to allow this, and not, it is actually up to the Senate to say, yeah, actually, no.
So the jurors can make their own rules on the trial they're presiding over? What's the point of having the Chief Justice there then?
Well, he looks good in the robe. Do you know? Rehnquist designed his own robe. Gilbert and Sullivan related robe.
Because it was a Gilbert and Sullivan role, essentially.
Apparently.
No singing.
Yeah, those rules, the fluidity of the rules, are up to the Senate, the majority in the Senate, and the Democrats. Sort of the nuclear thing to get Democratic judges through under Obama, they got rid of the 60 vote thing. So Now things can be done with simple majority.
So during the House hearings, Republicans constantly complained that the people brought in to testify had no firsthand knowledge of anything that the president may or may not have done. But the people who did have the firsthand knowledge of those things were not allowed to testify, or they ignored subpoenas that were legal subpoenas. Well, now the GOP senators, led by Mitch McConnell, don't want to hear from witnesses. And the president, who has repeatedly said he'd like there to be witnesses, is now telling John Bolton he can't testify even if subpoenaed. So obviously, this is all politics. But how do voters view this? Do they see this as hypocrisy or what? How do they
see it? I kind of think voters are pretty cynical about the whole thing by now. I mean, the House, controlled by Democrats, did what they did, and the Senate Republicans are pretty much expected to do what they're going to do.
But to quote the McCarthy hearings, have these people no shame? I mean, seriously, what they have said in the past is on tape. We can hear it. They show it on the nightly news, and yet they reversed themselves. I thought flip-flopping was a bad thing.
It depends on whether you're with the flipper or the flopper. Again, truth has, very little meaning to somebody who's so deeply partisan. The color of sunlight depends on the shade of the lens you're looking at it through.
Well, I want to talk about Lindsey Graham in a second. But South Carolina is a red state, solidly in the Trump camp, Scott. Have you polled voters with the Winthrop poll on their impressions on impeachment and the issues surrounding it?
No, it hasn't come up. Because we're going to do Democratic primary polls for the next one and the last one that we did. And they are obviously, in favor of impeachment. But nationally, it's growing, the number of people who favor impeachment. Obviously, South Carolina, which, as you said, it's deep red. But the South Carolina primary is going to sort of shake things up, because the people who are leading in Iowa and New Hampshire are definitely not leading in any. But y'all, because you're here, and of course I grew up in North Carolina, but got another Super Tuesday. It's North Carolina is kind of relevant again, when it was far too late. However, California and Texas and a couple other big states.
Yeah, but although we're an important state among California and Texas, because we have a lot
delegates.
You're a swing state too.
And for people who don't know, we used to have our primary in May, which made us completely irrelevant. The decision had already been made, so we moved it up to March 3rd to be on Super Tuesday to have some relevance in the issue. A lot of people are legitimately puzzled by Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, who during the Clinton impeachment insisted that you could not have a trial in the Senate without witnesses, but who now says not only are witnesses not necessary, he's already made up his mind that this is a sham. Well, as I said, videotape of him saying these things exists, and it's been played repeatedly on national news. How is that playing in South Carolina?
Beautifully.
Why?
Beautifully for him.
Why?
His approval ratings, when he went bonkers on the Supreme Court nomination. And again, it's always amazing to think I would love for SNL or somebody to have a woman saying the same things that these folks were saying with the same fervor and see if they would be called passionate or shrill.
And hysterical.
Right. But so as soon as he did that and was shown that he was faithfully in the Trump camp, mm-hmm. his approval rating with Republicans went up 30 points. He was the lowest favored Republican or among Republicans until he did that. So, you know, they're saying, well, this is absolutely right. And they don't care that it was literally his words that said a president who refuses to allow, you know, his staff today should be gone.
He has said, I'm not trying to pretend to be a fair juror here. This thing will come to the Senate and it will die quickly, and I will do everything I can to make it die quickly. This is a guy who's going to swear to uphold the Constitution when he becomes a juror. All of this, I would think, is about those poll numbers. All of this is because he does have a challenger that seems to be doing okay in a Republican state, and that's Jamie Harrison.
Yeah, and you know, and again, it's always a matter of turnout, right? We actually have a significant number of Democrats in South Carolina, but the Republicans, who are just slightly larger, also turn out more. We're a plus 10 state, right? A Republican, generic Republican, is going to beat a generic Democrat by 10 points in general, unless the Democrats turn out dramatically.
Steve and Jim, was it always this way? I mean, this seems to be, winning is the only thing that matters. Staying in office is the only thing that matters. Morals, principles, whatever else may be there, cast it aside. It's only about staying in office.
Well, with
has it always been that way?
You know, what we talked about with Lindsey Graham, I mean, Tom Tillis did the same thing just a few months ago to a lesser extent, and it's worked so far really well for him. I mean, his primary challenger bowed out, and he's in a much better position than he was in January. So,
but you know, don't say that the politicians, though, in the past had morals or anything else. But yeah, I mean, you know, you think of Chester A. Arthur, right, and his patron in the Senate, Conklin. I mean, they only cared about graft. You know, so it was. Just as bad at any
how have
other
we
person.
Made it this far? How have we made it? Have we made it 200 and some years? With
well, that's a good question. But you know, one of the reasons for what Steve was talking about and Scott about people being more worried about reelection is gerrymandering too. I mean, people are in districts now across the country where the election doesn't take place in November, but it takes place in the primary.
Are we more aware of it than we used to be? Because it seems to me that if parents with children of school age let them watch the shenanigans on television among politicians, there is no right, there is no wrong, there's nothing you can do that's wrong. Even though it's horribly wrong, if you tell your kid don't do this, they're doing exactly what you're telling them not to do.
Oh, well, are
we more aware of it now, and will that change things going forward?
Well, you know, it used to be, you know, you know what, you could grow up to be president. Now it's, if you don't start behaving, you're the kind of person who would grow up to be president.
So Senator Lindsey Graham's challenger, Democrat Jamie Harrison, has the advantage of not having to be in Washington during the upcoming Senate trial, which may last 24 minutes.
Right.
Who knows? But he's in the state, and apparently he's focusing on things other than impeachment when he's out on the stump. And in an article in the Post and Courier in Charleston, you, Scott, are quoted as saying that this is a way Harrison can go after independents, Democrats, and some Republicans who may not be in Trump's camp. So when we come back from the break, are there enough of those people in South Carolina where Republicans hold all of the offices for that to make a difference? We'll come back and talk with Dr. Scott Hoffman from Winthrop College about that. Steve Harrison is here from WFAE News, and Jim Morrill from the Charlotte Observer. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Scott Huffman is here from Winthrop University. Steve Harrison from WFAE News, and Jim Morrill, political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And I referred to Democrat Jamie Harrison running against Lindsey Graham in South Carolina for the United States Senate. He's not in Washington. He's in the trenches stumping, and he's not talking about impeachment. So are there enough people that he can win over in the independent camp, Republicans who may be kind of over certain things about their party? Are there enough people he can win over to really provide a serious challenge to Lindsey Graham?
Yeah, he's going to provide a serious challenge. I mean, you know, when you look at it, even if Lindsey Graham wins as expected, it's not going to be a blowout. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when you think blowouts, you got to remember that in the Democratic primary, Hillary Clinton beat Bernie Sanders by like 50 points. That's a blowout. This is going to be within, you know, single digits, and it may be about converting a few of the Republicans when he's saying, listen, here are the issues, let's, you know, not get involved in impeachment. But the other part is, if impeachment, you know, just disgusts those Republicans that are on the margins as much as it fires up the others, then if they don't turn out and Jamie Harrison's base does turn out and independents show up for him too, he's going to make it close. It was Superintendent of Education was the last thing held by the Democrats in South Carolina. No statewide offices now, and the only offices that they do hold are, like Jim pointed out, those seats are so gerrymandered. You know, somebody from the other party couldn't, and the Democrats are just as guilty of that as the Republicans.
We talked about Lindsey Graham already saying he's made up his mind about this impeachment. So has Mitch McConnell, who's driving the train. Tom Tillis, Senator from North Carolina, has also said he will definitely vote no on any Trump impeachment. These are gentlemen, along with the rest of the senators, who will take an oath to be impartial at this trial. If they've already made up their mind and publicly announced that they have made up their mind, what does that say about them? What does it say about the value of oaths being taken to the Constitution in any form?
That's a good question. I was going to say, in fairness, I think it's true on the other side, too. I think some Democrats have staked themselves out.
Well, I'm fine.
You raise a good point.
And then, Jim, you and I covered that press conference that Tillis had back in the fall when some of the Ukraine, it was about immigration, but some of the Ukraine stuff was just coming out that would look pretty bad, and no one quite knew where it would go. And at that point, Tillis and the other Republicans, they did play the I need to wait and see all the facts card. You know, they didn't know how it was going to go, so it was, well, I can't really speak about this because I'm going to have to be a juror, et cetera, et cetera. It's just funny to watch it.
Can you operate this country if people just flagrantly violate oaths?
Well, you know, I think people's voters' belief in government is getting tested all the time. You know, and that's one.
Where's
one
the
way.
Breaking point? It seems to me that we're really close to a breaking point where it doesn't matter anymore. You're all crooks, all of you.
Well, you're talking about things chipping away at the rule of law. And so, you know, if we believe in the rule of law that everybody is equally accountable to the, you know, under the law, mm-hmm. then that's sort of been, you know, our operating system for all. But it's never fully been true. It's just been something that we believe. You know, the truth is there are no parking laws for rich people. It's just they pay extra for parking. They get a $250, you know, you're a billionaire, you get a $250 parking ticket. That you just paid $250 to park there. So, you know, we've never truly had the rule of law the way, you know, our ideals say it operates in the Constitution. But we're now, you know, seeing that as clearly as possible. And that, I think, goes to the breaking point you're talking
about. So North Carolina, Steve, is not as red as South Carolina. Is Tom Tillis making a mistake in his approach toward this impeachment in North Carolina where he could lose his office?
I mean, I don't think so. I don't know. I mean, obviously, half the initial part of his calculation was his primary challenge, which is now gone. So that was his initial focus, was to not get defeated from the right. But I don't think that coming out 110% in favor of the president is going to cost him that many votes. I'm not saying that he will necessarily win, but moderating his position and opposing the president a few times, I don't know if that would really win him any new votes either.
I think this is a state where President Trump is still expected at this point to have a good chance of winning in the fall. And so as long as that's true, and he would be a strong candidate in the fall regardless,
but if
Senator Tillis is in good you know, in good shape.
But if Tom Tillis takes this position, and in fact it turns out that the president will be exonerated because of they're not taking this seriously in the Senate, and it appears on the face of it as we go through this trial that they have not taken it seriously in the Senate, and it becomes transparent to voters in a state where he's running against a strong Democrat. We don't know who that Democrat will be until March 3rd. Could Democrats be so angry about the process that there'd be enough of them to take the office away from Tom Tillis in November?
Well, there could be, and obviously Democrats hope so, but the Democrats, one of the Democrats' leading contenders for Senate so far, Cal Cunningham, I don't think has spoken out about impeachment. So it's not that big enough an issue for him, apparently. Well,
nobody's
right now
talking about impeachment. The presidential candidates aren't talking about impeachment. Is that because this is a non-issue? Voters don't seem to care. The candidates aren't talking about it because it's not a winning issue for them either way.
Beyond not, you know, for some, it's not a winning issue. But think strategically. When you know all the Democrats on the stump, are they going to say, "Well, I'm in favor of impeachment because"? All the other Democrats aren't. I mean, there's no reason for them to come out and say, right, I'm in favor of impeachment, because all the other Democrats are as well. And of course, the Democratic primary voters are the most passionate Democrats, just like the Republican primary voters. And so in South Carolina, certainly when they come down, you know, to us, it's 2/3 African American, 2/3 women. So you know that that group is in favor of impeachment, so it's superfluous.
Evidently, I used the word exonerated a minute ago when I talked about what may happen as a result of the Senate trial. He will not be exonerated. He will be acquitted, most likely, the president, but he will say, I was exonerated. So I was just a step ahead of him.
And don't forget that there are at least four Democratic presidential candidates who are members of the Senate, so
right,
they'll be prospective jurors.
Speaking of them, the latest polls in the Iowa caucuses show that Bernie Sanders has a very narrow lead over Elizabeth Warren, followed by Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden, each separated by one percentage point. I think in a race where the margin of error is 3.4%. So anybody could win.
Nobody's ahead then.
Nobody's ahead. So how does that compare to numbers those candidates may have in our states, North and South Carolina, leading into your primary in South Carolina on February 9th and ours on March the 3rd? How do they compare? March the 29th.
Well, Biden obviously is ahead in South Carolina.
And will stay that way.
He seems to stay that way. It's, you know, he is the most trusted by the African American voters. As I said, 2/3 are going to be African American. You know, he has put his foot in his mouth in the past so much, and you know, and we talk about that, and we talk about Neil Kinnock and all the other things that have been in his history. But he was, he had Obama's back for 8 years, and that's how they see it. And it's just sort of, I think he believes in the things I believe in because he backed up Barack Obama. And African-American Democrats were much more likely than white Democrats to say it's more important for somebody to believe what I believe rather than I want somebody who'll beat Trump. The white Democrats said, I want somebody who'll beat Trump. The African-American Democrats said, I want somebody who believes what I believe. It's about trust. And they don't trust most of the other candidates because they don't know them.
What about North Carolina?
I think North Carolina, the polls mirror South Carolina pretty much. Really? I think they've shown Biden with a lead here. But in North Carolina, the number of African Americans in the Democratic primary is lower than in South Carolina. But I think there are a lot of moderate Democrats who are looking at having a Biden on top of the ticket and the effect that would have on the rest of the ticket.
I don't think North Carolina's been polled. It's been a long time. I mean, I haven't seen anything recent.
There haven't been a lot of presidential race polls, period, anywhere in the country. Why is that? I know they're expensive to do, but why?
They're expensive to do.
Yeah, I mean, so what? We've done them in the past.
Well, sure. I think people are sort of mixing up, you know, why isn't their polling being done versus why isn't their polling being done by the entities that are considered threshold polls. And so for us, and we're a threshold poll for South Carolina, it's been a combination of other commitments and money.
If Bernie wins in Iowa, if Bernie Sanders wins in New Hampshire, what impact would that have or could that have on the South Carolina and North Carolina primaries, if you have a clear winner that's way ahead of Joe Biden in those two, what happens, or in Nevada for that matter, what happens here?
Well, in Nevada, I think Biden is ahead in polls there too, but I think that there is definitely a bump. If you win Iowa and New Hampshire too, there's a bump going into South Carolina, but whether that can withstand a Biden firewall in South Carolina and on Super Tuesday, I don't know. I don't know that Bernie Sanders, who I understand is also doing pretty well in California, which is a big Super Tuesday prize, on March 3rd.
There's something else weird that's going on. It's the age thing. All the young people like Bernie, and some of the older people like Pete Buttigieg. And the younger people, right.
Yeah, they think not interested at all. It's fascinating.
So is Bernie Sanders Eugene McCarthy?
Yeah, I guess in a way he is, you know. He's definitely got a big following of people here. I don't know how big it is, but... You know, when I covered him at Central Piedmont, I don't know if you were, Steve was there,
but
too.
But McCarthy got creamed.
Well, he did, but the person who won that nomination didn't even have a primary.
Well, I wonder why. That was Hubert Humphrey.
Back to the young people, I keep getting this saying, well, all, you know, among young people, it's completely different. It's completely different. And what I always say is, okay, go back and look at the turnout among the 18 to 24-year-olds. They're 5% of the primary. And, you know, and they're still going to only be probably less than 10% of the primary. So you can be wildly ahead among that age group, but until – and those are – what do you call – is it still Gen Z? Whatever, these are not millennials. Millennials are you know, in their 30s, pushing 40.
They're approaching retirement.
Yeah, exactly. they're finally going to get full time at McDonald's because of all the frickin' jobs that the boomers didn't leave for them. For the record, I'm a Gen Xer, so I hate everybody.
So it's 99.9% certain that Donald Trump will come away with the Republican nomination after his acquittal in the Senate.
And I'm going to say something I never thought I would say in my entire life. I miss Mark Sanford. I wanted him to say that would have been fascinating to watch.
So the only process really that counts right now is the Democratic side of the aisle, where there's a horse race at the moment. Are Democrats taking North Carolina seriously enough?
You know, I that remains to be seen. You know, ultimately, after South Carolina, there's only 3 days before North Carolina, and we're on a very crowded schedule of primaries that day with Super Tuesday. But as somebody said earlier, North Carolina does matter in the fall, and so candidates are looking at North Carolina not only for the primary but for the general. And it's interesting that the candidate who's not in the first four contest in February, Michael Bloomberg, is the only one really on TV in North Carolina. Right. He spent $500,000 so far.
Well, once the caucuses and the primary in New Hampshire and Nevada are over, then they're facing South Carolina and Super Tuesday. So are they going to be killing two birds with one stone because the media markets overlap in some cases?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the Greenville in South Carolina, the Greenville media market overlaps in North Carolina. You know, if they want to buy in sort of Rock Hill, which York County was the fastest growing county in South Carolina, it's going to be in the Charlotte media market. And, of course, the Myrtle Beach media market overlaps as well. So, in a way, they are getting it out. But Jim's point is, I think, the most important. Whoever gets the nomination is going to pay North Carolina a lot of attention in the fall. Virginia and North Carolina are going to get a lot of visits.
I was going to say, but even before the primaries, will we see the kind of thing that we're seeing in Iowa? Iowa gets a heck of a lot of attention. I don't get it.
You know,
why don't we have one primary on the same day across the country?
Although, would you want everybody's vote to count equally, Mike?
I can't imagine. Yeah.
Although I think in this cycle, I was reading a story that when they looked at the days the candidates have spent in Iowa, it is way down.
Really?
In 2020 compared to the Obama 2008. I mean, there's.
But will that compare to the amount of time they will spend on the ground shaking hands, eating barbecue North and South Carolina?
Still 100 times more. I'm just saying, but they have kind of.
Don't we have more voters? Don't we have more impact on the actual general election?
More voters, more impact.
So why?
More representative of the party and the nation.
You know, they'll go to California during the primaries for Super Tuesday delegates, but that'll be the last time they go to California to campaign because it's a blue state. And I misspoke earlier. Bloomberg has spent $5 million in North Carolina on TV.
Okay.
Far and away, more than anybody.
Are you not seeing Tom Steyer's ads too? Because I got rid of cable.
He's gone up in the polls in South Carolina. How do you figure that?
If you're in South Carolina, that's all you see. If you get on YouTube, if you get on, you know, and even my streaming stuff in Hulu or whatever, it pops up, he's just everywhere. And I assume he's everywhere on regular TV as well. He's on my Facebook feed constantly. I assume he's spending a boatload of money as well.
What is the impact of people recording everything now and skipping through the commercials on these political? Because I'll tell you, I'm not going to watch a political commercial because they're all lies, every single one of them.
Well, I think a lot of people don't skip through all of the commercials. I think people like me, we just watch TV.
Let me backtrack. I don't think that Tom Steyer is necessarily lying. I think he's talking about what he wants to do. And I think Michael Bloomberg is talking about what he wants to do from the ones that I have seen so far.
But it's kind of if Tom Steyer actually believes that, then that's probably not good. You know, term limits, what you end up getting with term limits, and this has been proven in states where they got term limits. We all say, oh, we want them out. What happens is lobbyists end up with more power because of lack of experience. And, you know, lobbyists have already enough power in Congress.
So Catawba College political scientist Michael Bitzer, who's a frequent guest on this program, says it will be important for whoever gets the Democratic nomination next summer to use the time right now to lay the groundwork for the general election. You all agree with that?
Structure, people on the ground,
Are they doing it?
That I don't know, but think about it as circuitry. I mean, you know, that's you want to be ready to put in the charge and it to go out to all the important parts of the state. So I think that it's – I don't know who's on the ground.
I think Michael Bloomberg is the only person to open campaign offices in North Carolina, right?
Well, I think Elizabeth Warren might have, and Biden has a state director, but I don't know about any offices. But Bloomberg has 100 people on the ground in North Carolina.
Right, that's a lot of people.
I mean, 100 paid staffers. That's a lot.
So the next debate on the Democratic side is tomorrow night. I want to come back and talk about issues. We always talk about the horse race. Who's ahead? Why? Let's talk about why. What are they saying that seems to be resonating? We'll do that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE with Jim Morrill, Scott Huffman, and Steve Harrison. Political junkies all.
Did you know that Charlotte is hosting the Republican National Convention? It's true. And on January 23rd, WFAE is launching Inside Politics, a new podcast hosted by Steve Harrison and me, Lisa Wharf, about the RNC and the 2020 presidential race through the lens of Charlotte. Listen to the trailer and subscribe to Inside Politics now on NPR One and WFAE.org/InsidePolitics.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jim Morrill is here, longtime reporter, a political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Steve Harrison, our political reporter here at WFAE and the co-host of the soon-to-be podcast Inside Politics, which drops on the 23rd of January. And Dr. Scott Huffman, political science professor and director of the Winthrop Poll at Winthrop University. Wall Street Journal calls Michael Bloomberg's approach to North Carolina the long haul strategy, which includes spending lots of money opening campaign field offices here in the state where no other candidate evidently has one, at least didn't when they wrote that article. What does he see about North Carolina that these other candidates do not?
Well, I think he sees it as part of his post-February strategy. North Carolina's, again on Super Tuesday, which Bloomberg is focusing on. North Carolina's got more delegates at stake than any state but California and Texas. And so he's looking at the long haul.
And he's betting on Super Tuesday. He's ignoring the first three primaries. Is that smart?
Well, we'll find out. It hasn't been smart yet in American history for anybody to do that. I think Rudy Giuliani tried it a few years ago on the Republican side.
Well, he's got money to stay in, whereas most of the others, if they hadn't got some name recognition or if they hadn't picked up some delegates before this, they would have to be out.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you see Super Tuesday, you see an overwhelming win in California, you see a big win in Texas, but then all of a sudden they have to do a story if Michael Bloomberg wins all these delegates from North Carolina, which it may be third, even though Massachusetts is the same day as far as number of delegates. Every story is going to have to say, but Bloomberg won North Carolina, which has blank delegates. So, I mean, if you can, basically you have to force the hand of, oh, well, this was overwhelming for this, for Bernie or whomever, but, so I again, the long haul strategy,
and,
I guess.
Bloomberg's campaign office is less than a mile from the arena, which is where Donald Trump will accept the nomination for the Republican Party in August. He's made a $15 to $20 million commitment, though. Whether he loses or stays in the presidential race or not, he's made this commitment to register 500,000 voters in five states, including North Carolina, so that other Democratic candidates have a better shot at beating their Republican opponents. Can that have an impact? Can that tip some races toward Democrats who might have a tough time of it?
It could, but, you know, I think Tom Steyer tried that, too, before. Tom Steyer has invested, I think, $1 million in North Carolina through one of his organizations to register voters before, and maybe it had a marginal effect.
Well, it's been tested. Remember Motor Voter? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, every DMV and, you know, of course, in the South, they fought it tooth and nail, and you know, they were finally forced to just, you know, lay a stack of voter things out there, and that's all they did. Whereas in some states, you would show up and they would register you. But over the years, what a study of post-motor voter showed was, yeah, a lot more people were registered. So what you got were a lot more registered non-voters.
So let's talk about messaging. We've talked a lot about process. Let's talk about messaging. What seems to be happening in South Carolina on either side of the aisle in terms of what messages are resonating with the partisans there and maybe some of the independents who might be swayed to go one way or the other?
Well, of course, I mean, the Republicans are hunkering down, and it's very much about impeachment. It's about they won't call them Democrats or Democrat. The Democrat Party, is evil, and you know they're going after this man who wants to make America great again. Of course, they're hunkering down for Trump. Now, on the Democratic side, global warming, climate change is important, especially when we've got in South Carolina so much of our economy dependent on tourism and along the coast. So you have people down there who want to hear about climate change in the low country. So the Democrats in the low country want to hear about climate change. The Democrats in the PD region and the Corridor of Shame, you know, are much more African American, lower income. They want to hear about the economy. And that makes them mad whenever you hear, oh, the economy's doing great. It's doing great for some people, but not others. So there are things other than impeachment that South Carolina voters, Democratic voters, are deeply concerned about and will impact them.
Similar in North Carolina? Are we seeing certain messages be more important than others?
You know, I think for a lot of Democrats here, it's a question of who can win, who can beat the president in November. You know, that's why I think a lot of Democrats here think that a more moderate Democratic nominee like a Vice President Biden or somebody like him could win.
How important is it for Democratic voters who want to see whoever the nominee is beat the president to consider what nominee has coattails so that they can also take the House and keep the House and take the Senate?
Yeah, I think that's important.
Do you think voters are aware? Are they thinking about that anywhere in the country?
You know, I wouldn't think that. I just think it's, if you're a Democratic voter, I think 99% of what you're thinking is just beating the president.
Because if you keep if the Senate stays under Mitch McConnell's control, you're going to have a repeat of the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. Nothing will get done. Nothing that the president wants to do will get done because it won't go through the Senate ever.
Well, you know, Democrats are thinking about that. Washington Democrats are certainly thinking about that. And in North Carolina, if I could shift to the General Assembly and the legislative races, I think Democrats are thinking about that too, and so are Republicans, because whoever is elected to the legislature this year will control congressional and legislative districts for another decade.
Fox News ranks Joe Biden at 36%. This is a Fox News poll, and Fox News polls are legitimate.
Yeah.
Even for Democrats who ignore Fox News, their polling is legitimate. Yeah. So Joe Biden at 36%. Tom Steyer is at 15%.
Is this a national poll?
Yes. Bernie Sanders. I think. I'm not sure. I think it's in South Carolina. South Carolina. Joe Biden at 36, Tom Steyer 15%, Bernie Sanders 14%, Elizabeth Warren 10%. That means that Steyer has made significant inroads over two candidates that have been running for a long time, who are doing really well elsewhere, and who are way to the left of most Palmetto State voters.
Then we have the answer to my question earlier. And like I said, I finally cut the cable. So apparently the people that do have the cable are seeing Tom Steyer ads, and that, because that's the only way. Once people put up their political radar and he blankets them with ads, then that's working.
You were talking about how the Republicans refer to the Democrat Party.
Democrat Party, yeah.
I think that irks me because I was an English minor. Just dropping the ick.
Yeah.
It means something. Words mean something, right? So I think that the Democrats should fight back by calling them the Republics. That's it. All right, the race for Tom Tillis and his Senate seat in North Carolina is on track to be one of the most expensive in the country. Where's the money coming from?
Well, a lot of it will come from outside. Some of it already is. I forgot how much. But, the last time Tom Tillis ran in 2014, it was the most expensive race in American history up to that point.
And it was tiny by comparison, right?
Well, it was like $114 million or something.
Was it that much? Because Democrat Cal Cunningham raised $1.6 million in the last quarter of 2019 to total $3.1 million since announcing his candidacy in June. He seems to be the leading Democrat at the moment. By comparison, these are the figures that I had. Tom Tillis, when he ran against the late Kay Hagan, raised $714,000 in the final quarter of 2013. So how much has he raised this time? Do you know?
I don't think he's said yet, but...
Cunningham has outpaced how much Tillis raised at the same period as both being challengers. But it's interesting with this race. I mean, Cal Cunningham has raised by far the most money among the Democrats. He has the support of Washington Democrats. He is the chosen candidate. Mm-hmm. But there's only been really one poll on this race, and Erica Smith, the state senator, was ahead by a little bit. And I mean, not that that's like really the word, but there hasn't been, I guess I'm saying maybe I would have expected Cunningham's campaign to put out their own poll if they had something that was really dramatically different, and haven't seen that yet. So
it's been a very quiet race for something that's coming up really quickly.
And there are no debates scheduled.
No debates. Trevor Fuller, who's from here, is running in the race. I've heard nothing.
Well, we think he's running. he had raised hardly any money at the last report, and the current report's not out yet, but... he's been invisible.
So are they giving up prior to the primary because Cal Cunningham has the national seal of approval?
Well,
and more
Smith
money
isn't giving up.
Yeah, she is not giving up at all. I mean, she is a from a journalist standpoint, a great interview.
Really?
Because she just will, like, come out guns blazing. I mean, she does not. She answers every question. She will criticize Cal Cunningham. I mean, there's this – I think the most interesting part of the race so far – has been the comments, the off-the-record comments that Jeff Jackson made at the UNC Charlotte classroom, where he talked about he considered running for this race, but he was told, you're going to be in the windowless basement just raising money. We don't want you doing town halls and et cetera. We just, we are going to go negative on Tom Tillis. And so both Erica Smith and Tillis have characterized Cunningham as that guy who is dialing for dollars.
Something wrong with that?
What's that?
Is there something wrong with that? You got to do it.
Right. Yeah. Right. That may be the best strategy.
Tillis is regarded as one of the most vulnerable incumbents in the Senate. Why?
Well, there was a poll, a morning consult poll a few months ago or a few weeks ago that showed that he wasn't that popular in North Carolina. And, I think there are some, he's one of the vulnerable Republican senators along with the senator from Colorado and Maine. And, he's just not that popular. He had a strong Republican challenger for a while before he dropped out.
Why is he not popular among Republicans? Because he flip-flopped a little bit? He waffled on the president?
I think there are some Republicans that don't trust him for
which
for
is
that
why
reason.
He's doubling down now and saying, I'm before it. You know, a lot of the spending that's going to come negative on Tillis, those are those, 501c4 groups and the super PAC groups. That's where those $100 million of spending comes from. It's not all necessarily, in fact,
candidates.
It's not even mostly going to be candidates. It's mostly going to be.
I mean, remember at the MAGA rally in Fayetteville for Dan Bishop, when Tillis was introduced, he got booed.
Really?
That was September. So a lot has changed. I mean, I think, you know, when you lose your primary challenger and you stick as close to the president as he has, I don't know if he'd be booed today. That may be different. But there was definitely a period where he did not have...
Yeah, his vulnerability doesn't come, I don't think, from Republicans not being willing to vote for him. I think his vulnerability is because North Carolina is a swing state, and if there is a massive, you know, get out the vote push here, and if it is seen as important by Democrats, then whoever the Democratic presidential candidate is, if they get a bump in Democratic leaning voters, then that's what hurts Tillis.
And will we see, once the primary is over on March the 3rd, and we know who the Democratic candidate for Senate is going to be, will we see, because we haven't seen any of these people campaigning here that I know of, will we see that?
Yeah, I think he will at that point. You know, he's been raising money, whether it's been in a windowless basement or not. You know, Cal Cunningham has been mainly raising money, so he hasn't been as visible. But if he wins, yes, he would.
Any cracks in the Lindsey Graham veneer in South Carolina?
Among Republicans, no. He's been doubly shellacked. There is no cracking that veneer at this point.
Democrats are hoping that the 2018 midterm results in North Carolina are reason for hope in taking back Tillis' seat, the state legislature, and winning the vote for president. And Republican strategist Larry Shaheen says to him, 2018 looks like an aberration. Democrats think that because of the blue wave that they experienced here locally in Mecklenburg County and around the state, that's going to carry through in the 2020 race. Any reason to believe that what happened here in 2018 was a fluke, a blue fluke?
Well, you don't see the turnout in a midterm election that you see in a general election like this. And, you know, I think that's one reason you see former Republican office holders running for their old offices again, like Bill Brawley and John Bradford for the state legislature here.
What's actually an aberration is the party of the president not losing seats in the midterm. It is much more common. In fact, it's only happened a couple of times, and Bush was one of them. It is much more common for the party of the president to lose seats in the midterm after he gets elected.
It's important to Democrats to take control or retake control of state legislatures, including the North Carolina legislature, not only because they want the power in those state houses, but because of the 2020 census, because the people in power after the 2020 census will redraw the maps again. Is flipping the North Carolina legislature a pipe dream for Democrats? Can they do it?
I don't know if it's a pipe dream. You know, they only need a few seats. It's not a pipe dream, but it's not likely necessarily. I think even with all the redrawing of districts that took place this past year, they still tend to favor Republicans. So
there's
Democrats would love to do
it. There's a Democratic super PAC called Forward Majority targeting several states, including North Carolina. They're looking to pick up 50 legislative seats in Florida, Texas, Arizona, and North Carolina that Democrats nearly won in 2018. Do we know how they're doing that? Is it just pumping money into races? That's it?
I'm sure it'll be money and people on the ground. You know, Republicans did this in 2010. You know, Democrats fell asleep at the switch in that year, and Republicans put money into legislative races and won and took control of the General Assembly.
It is said that Donald Trump must win North Carolina in order to be reelected. Is that true?
Well, that's what they say, because they say Democrats have to win the Rust Belt states, the Pennsylvanias and Ohios and Michigans, in order to win, but Trump...
In the modern era, any Republican who has swept the South has become president, and any Democrat who has cracked the South with at least two states has become president. And North Carolina has become, along with Virginia, hypercritical swing states. So I think that's where the perception of important, and it is important. I mean,
I think for Democrats, you don't need North Carolina. I mean, Obama 2012 didn't take it,
and but you got a crack bonus. But yeah, it's not the key for Democrats.
So what impact, if any, does the presence of the Republican National Convention being in North Carolina going to have on that race?
On his ability
to take North Carolina, President Trump, very quickly.
You know, they'll put a lot more resources in here, and it'll bring a lot more attention to North Carolina.
Jim Morrill, political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Steve Harrison, our political reporter here at WFAE, who will be the co-host of Inside Politics podcast, which starts January 23rd. And Dr. Scott Huffman, political science professor and director of the Winthrop Poll at Winthrop University. Thank you all. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.